on air, online,
on digital,
and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, research underway to tap into the root system of barley to increase productivity.
Yeah, we're using drones fitted out with the latest sensing technology, so multispectral cameras, and we're measuring traits on the canopy of the crop, which could be reflective of what's going on underground.
And the multi-million dollar project to plant the biggest field in the world of a special flower in Tasmania.
We have got the outline for 10 hectares, which is 46 concentric circles. We have got that in the ring. And then total length of the ring, which we call the flower bed, would be 28 kilometres.
Be a decent old walk through the gardens, wouldn't it? 28 kilometres. The field of Gomphrena flower under construction at a southern Tasmanian farm. Coming up later in the program, and a question for dairy farmers today, which dairy area is getting the highest price per kilo of milk solids? Bet you can't guess. We'll find out later in the program. But if you think you do know, send us a text on 0438 922 936, 0438 922 936. Tony with you on this Thursday, where we also look at the research into barley and attempts to breed a better root system for the grain. But first up, the trade issue with China. Cast your mind back to the last year for a moment. Remember the trade sanctions imposed on Australian agricultural products by China. Last year, for example, the country said Australian wine was being dumped in China at an unfair price. But now a Chinese official has openly declared Beijing has singled out Australia for economic punishment. A Foreign Affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, has been following the story. He spoke with reporter Peter Somerville about the latest development.
What we're seeing here, I think, is that the rhetoric emanating from China has now basically just caught up to the reality. I mean, it's been obvious now for months that what we've seen from China is, in fact, a coordinated campaign of economic punishment or coercion, depending on how you want to phrase it. We've seen so many industries hit, some in the case of barley and wine, with formal actions at the WTO, and others with informal or grey zone measures from China, whether that be problems at the border with supposed biosecurity measures or other problems with paperwork. So what's really changed here is that China has shifted from so-called grey zone tactics, insisting that it has legitimate complaints with Australia on things like wine and barley, talking about biosecurity problems. What's happened now is that it's moved from those plausible deniability tactics to straight out economic intimidation. So the veil, if you like, has been ripped away. That thin veneer of deniability is gone. And now we have a frank admission from China, from the foreign ministry spokesman earlier this week, that what this is really about is about political retaliation. Now, we knew that was the case. It was obvious. It was something that was being said privately by the Chinese. It was something that the federal government had been saying both, you know, privately and then increasingly publicly. But it is interesting that Beijing has now made this step quite decisively of putting it all out there and simply saying, yes, this is about Australia, quote unquote, smearing China and undermining China's core interests. What they're doing is they're making it crystal clear, not just to Australia, but also to other nations, that there are certain red lines that can't be crossed. And if you do cross them, then there is likely to be an economic consequence.
So a change in the messaging from China. Is there going to be any change from Australia now? Do you think we will see the lines coming out of government here change as a result of this?
Look, possibly. The government has already been a little bit more forward-leaning, particularly in the last few months. When these measures first were unveiled, and we have to remember, of course, that the pace has really slackened off this year, right? It was really last year that most of these coercive measures were unveiled, one by one, particularly towards the back half of this year, of last year. This year, the pace has really slowed. We have seen many of those sanctions bedded in, if you like, particularly wine, And we've seen a few other industries face a few troubles, but nothing like the sort of pace that we saw last year, when it seemed that every 2 weeks or so, a new industry was facing a formal or informal sanction. So the pace has already slackened off to some extent. What will be interesting here to see, I think, is whether the federal government becomes increasingly bellicose now in its rhetoric. What we've seen is that the federal government has moved from essentially saying that they take the Chinese at their word and that they're trying to work behind closed doors to try and rectify these situations, that they regard them as technical challenges rather than political ones. We've seen a shift over this year to the federal government being more honest, if you like, with them recognising that this is fundamentally an act of economic coercion and political retaliation. Now, the government has also recently been pointing quite forcefully in public to Chinese demands, in particular the 14 demands that the Chinese embassy made via an Australian journalist last year, calling that an instance of coercion and saying that Australia couldn't be expected to compromise on any of the items within that. Now that China has gone out and quite openly said that it's engaging in economic coercion, it'll be interesting to see whether the government tries to use that to harness international support, both publicly or potentially privately. Will we see the Prime Minister now come out and say, look, China has admitted that this is about economic coercion and Australian sovereignty, and other countries need to be warned of the way that that China approaches these issues? Will he use it to try and, you know, rally further international support, as he did at the G7 when he, we now know, tabled the 14 demands in an attempt to try and bring other countries behind Australia to try and force China to back down and to cease its behaviour? I think that will be the interesting thing to track next, how the Australian government's rhetoric and how the Australian government's approach to international discussions about China and its behaviour, how it will be shaped by this shift.
That's the ABC's National Affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. And you can read more about that story on our website, ABC Rural, about the trade tensions, continuing tensions with China. Well, lamb and mutton prices are continuing to soar on the back of a steady increase in demand and a continuing lack of supply around the globe. It comes as the market passes another milestone, the percentage of the average weekly wage in Australia you need to afford to buy lamb is the highest it's been since the 80s. Market analyst Mac Dalglish from Thomas Elder Markets has told Luke Radford it's showing no sign of slowing down.
We're just creeping up into the mid-800s in terms of the trade lamb as the, I guess, most commonly viewed and quoted one. And that's, you know, not uncommon to see this start to pick up through winter. Certainly the normal seasonal pattern is for prices to appreciate through into winter and through late winter is generally when it peaks. And that's what we're kind of seeing now.
And you had a pretty interesting statistic on that as well. What is it?
Oh, yes. So we kind of look at quite a few different things, and every now and then we kind of look at something a bit obscure but interesting. And what we took a look at was the price of trade lamb versus the average weekly wage, just to see, you know, how long it takes to earn the ability to buy a trade lamb.
So where are we up to on that at the moment?
So it was an interesting chart, really, when you look at it, because it goes back to the 1950s, Luke. And so recently we've been seeing, obviously because prices are going up at the sale yard, we have seen that ratio creeping up, and it's kind of just sitting at about 9%. So basically, you know, one trade lamb, or an average trade lamb, about a 20 kilo carcass weight trade lamb, would cost about 10% of your weekly wage at the moment. So up from about 4 or 5%, you know, at around the early 2000s, late 90s. For the last probably 3 or 4 decades, it's been between that kind of 5 to 10% of the average weekly wage, and the last kind of 2 decades has been creeping up, you know, about a percent a year nearly. But previous to that, like back, if you go back to the 50s, the price of trade lamb was significantly higher relative to the average wage. It was nearly 30% of the weekly wage back in the 1950s. So it's at 9% now, and it was 10% back in 1981, and that was the last time we've seen trade lamb prices as high as this relative to average weekly wage.
So the big question, obviously, is why. All the commodities seem to be doing pretty well at the moment. What specifically is going on with lamb?
Obviously, if you look at the shorter term kind of cycle, this is the period of time when normally we see the peak during the normal year-on-year cycle. So that's one reason that we're in the kind of normal peak time for the season. But beyond that, we've also got a very good season and restocking happening, of course, and a very low flock. So the kind of current fundamentals, you know, that are the kind of medium-term drivers are also quite bullish because of that season and the low supply. But if you look even further than that and say, look over the last decade or so, we've seen a real growth in the export market for lamb and sheep meat as a product. And so that's also, over the last two decades, that's really been underpinning these successive higher and higher prices we've been seeing each year over the last two decades. It's really been that kind of access to the export market. And the interest, look, China's a big player, but we're also seeing some really big interest out of North America as well, which is a really good sign to have a diverse segment looking for our product.
When it comes to sort of the supply and demand side of things, is there much availability of sheep meat from other countries at the moment? Is that what's fueling the demand for Australian meat?
That's one of the other characteristics, I guess, when you look at sheep meat versus beef as an export market. The Australian sheep meat producer is actually in a really fortunate position because, unlike the beef space where there's quite a few competitors, international competitors, you know, trying to get their beef into other market, you know, areas, for sheep meat, it's really only New Zealand can compete with Australia. And Australia is actually the dominant supplier. So if you look at overall global exports of sheep meat, Australia nearly supplies about 40% of the world market, and New Zealand's at about 35%. So between the two of us, we're 75% of the export market. And that means that, you know, we've got that really dominant position to a degree a favoured position amongst, you know, those offshore consumers.
Are the Kiwis benefiting from this as well?
Yes, they are. But in saying that, within New Zealand over the last probably decade and a half, they've actually been, as a broad kind of move, they've been moving away from sheep meat to a degree and actually increasing their kind of enterprises into dairy and beef. And I mean, New Zealand, it's a much smaller geographical footprint, so the fight for acres over there is a little bit more kind of robust than in Australia. We've got much more land in Australia to have multiple enterprises. Within New Zealand, it's really the dairy and the beef space that's been taking a lot of the kind of growth in the agricultural side from a livestock perspective. And so, yeah, the sheep meat side, while they're still pretty dominant players or fairly important players, they haven't been as focused on kind of increasing their sheep meat footprint domestically.
Those international demand factors that are going on at the moment, is there any indication about how that's going to be impacted by the sort of resurgence of COVID through the Delta variant around Australia and around the world?
Look, the sheep meat is definitely a commodity that gets heavily impacted by disruptions to global growth. Part of the reason for that is if you look at somewhere like a key market like that North American market, 60% of the Australian product goes into the food service sector, and 60% of that goes into what they call the high-end kind of sit-down fancy restaurants, right? So when the US went through lockdown, we saw a significant drop in our exports to there for that period. And equally, when we've seen lockdowns into, you know, well, certainly the very original Chinese lockdown, I think it was February 2020, we saw a drop in flows into China for that particular month as well. So sheep meat's very susceptible to COVID, and it's because of that factor that so many of the offshore consumers look to eat sheep meat as a special occasion when they're out dining. And so any of those situations where you've got a restriction on the ability to, you know, for the hospitality sector being restricted, that does play into, you know, short-term hiccups for our market. Saying that, though, I think the majority of certainly the Northern Hemisphere and Asia are dealing with the COVID, the rollout of the vaccine quite well. So we are seeing already a pickup in those economies. And certainly if you look at America, they're really booming in terms of their hospitality sector's really come back online. They've really got in control of COVID in terms of the rollout of the vaccine. So, yeah, providing we don't see another variant that comes out that the vaccine doesn't respond to, I think it's looking like we're through the worst of it from a global demand perspective.
It's Matt Dalgleish from Thomas Elder Market speaking there with Luke Radford about the soaring lamb and mutton markets. Coming up, a successful transition from dairy to beef, and more on the cybersecurity issue.
Celebrating NAIDOC Week across the ABC.
Hello, I'm Daniel Browning. I'm from Bundjalung Country on the far north coast of New South Wales. We can't know the national story if we don't know the first story. So Indigenous perspectives are key to understanding this country. If we don't understand the stories that have been sung, danced and recited here for millennia, we don't know our story.
Celebrating NAIDOC Week. Find out more at abc.net.au/indigenous. Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Don't forget that text line number, 0438922936. Well, in the last 18 months, major players in Australia's beef, dairy and wool industries have been subject to cyber attacks. It's these threats that led AgriFutures Australia to commission research into how vulnerable rural industries in Australia are to these cyber attacks. BDO Australia led the project with its cybersecurity partner, John Borchi, telling Cara Jeffrey all players in the supply chain could be targeted.
What we wanted to do was not to look at the global threats and presume what's happening in Australia. So we started off by surveying the primary producers, the research development companies, the supply chain, the technologists in this area in Australia, to see what they say about cybersecurity and technology uptake and what they perceive the threats are.
And so what did the report find in terms of how rural industries in Australia are positioned to prevent and handle cybersecurity attacks?
So I think in broad terms, the industry thinks that it knows what's happening based on their understanding of what cybersecurity is. So when we did that survey, there was a high confidence that they understood cyber and they had it under control. But once we delved into the detailed questions like, do you know where your key information is and what it looks like? Do you know what technology it sits on? Do you have an ability to determine what the risks are and what you're doing about it? Those questions were very vague and basically it's showing us that we're at the low maturity. And that's not unusual with an industry that's just on the cusp of what every industry has gone through, a digital transformation, going from very manual processes and managing information and their business very manually to using a lot of tech. And that maturity journey, I think, is just where agribusiness is at the moment, at the very start. There are some larger players who've been on this journey for a couple of years, but they still have quite a bit of maturity to go through.
And why do you think rural industries are a target?
I think criminals don't discriminate. So wherever money can be made, that's where they target. And money's made from a couple of key areas. One is where your business is heavily reliant on information and technology, and they disable you from using that information and technology, so you have to pay money in order to get back into business, or where they get an upper hand, and this is more sophisticated activity, to identify what research development you're doing, how your product is better than theirs, what your go-to-market proposition is, and how they can beat you to that. So it's more commercial, what's called commercial espionage, and that's you know, that happens in every industry and starting to happen agribusiness as well.
And do you think lessons have been learnt from the cyber attacks that happened to the beef operation JBS and the wool industry in the last 18 months? Do you think there's been some lessons learnt from those incidents?
Well, I hope so. I think that there's more awareness now that this is a real thing. It's not science fiction. I think there's quite a few organisations now thinking, you know, what did happen there? What position are we in? Are we going to be susceptible to the same attacks? So when you consider some of the ag tech that's happening, you might see like more measurements for temperature and moisture, the presence of pests. You might see farm-wide networks, like Wi-Fi networks that run a lot of activities on the farm. You can get a lot of automation in the production line. You can get virtual fences where you don't have to have physical fences anymore, drones, satellite technology that measures, takes images and measures the conditions of your property, of your land, robots, you know, ranging from big ones to small ones, automated harvesters. So the technology is quite wide. How do you know what could go wrong and what you should do about it is not a simple question. It takes a bit of time to sit down with people who understand it to help you get that clearer picture. I think the understanding and the incidents have raised awareness that this could happen, but we need to know exactly what that looks like.
A lot of those technologies that you have mentioned, they're viewed a lot by agriculture as, you know, labour-saving and helpful on the farm, but do you think people are not really also thinking about those privacy and cyber risks as well that are associated with having those, I guess, tools on farm?
Yeah, I think criminals think differently to us. So when we use our email, when we use computers, when we use our internet banking, we don't think anyone's out there trying to do the wrong thing to break in. You know, that's just human nature. And I think the same happens here with ag tech, is that we think this is a useful tool and it is helping, and it's improving our ability to build more resilient products, to have more efficient processes. So it's all for the benefit of individuals and the broader community, because you know, this is the industry that provides food, shelter, clothing. So all these things are used very broadly, but we don't really understand how the bad guys think and what they're going to do with that data or that system that we're using, that technology. So if you think of an automated harvester that's working on satellite and GPS, if someone wants to do the wrong thing, they might start harvesting your crop earlier than it's supposed to, or might steer it into the wrong direction and destroy some of your farm installations and things like that. People will do that for various reasons. And we just need to know, what are those risks? What can we realistically do about it? So as you bring in new technology, you think about the areas that could go wrong, and you put in the stop gaps to make sure those things don't go wrong. Or if they do go wrong, you've got a plan to jump on it and fix it before it becomes, you know, a big issue where your farm stops working, your production stops working, you've got issues with staff having jobs or customers not getting their product. So it's all about taking reasonable steps to know what could happen.
It was BDO Australia cybersecurity partner John Bucci speaking there to Cara Jeffrey. And if you want to know more about how your rural business can manage cybersecurity risk, visit Agri Futures Australia online. Farming can be an extremely demanding profession, as you know, and as you get older, you might want to take a step back from the daily grind. Now, there's numerous ways to do this. You could sell your property, find a share farmer, or leave it all to the kids. But for fifth-generation Wesley Vale farmer Geoffrey Lyon, the best option was to switch from dairy to beef.
I've been dairying all my life, ever since I came back from ag college, and by the time when I got to 68, I decided that I didn't have any more dairy left in me, and my son didn't want to take on dairying, so we didn't really want to leave the farm or sell the farm or lease the farm out. So we thought of an easy way to be on the farm and still make a living, or hopefully.
And a number of people around the Northwest and Tasmania more generally have done a similar thing to you for various different reasons. What have you found the experience to be like?
Been interesting. You certainly need to talk to people and get some good ideas, but I did find that my idea of beef farming was, I wanted to be a lot easier than what most people do, so it was a bit of a challenge finding a really easy care system.
How much does it actually cost to make that move? How expensive was this transition for you?
Well, I think we got, when we sold our 300 head of dairy cows, I think we got somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 for them, and I wasn't really thinking at the time, but after 12 months of setting up into beef, buying and selling beef, it's cost us nearly every cent of that to set up into beef.
And is that just buying the livestock, or were there additional infrastructure you needed to invest in?
No, that's pretty much all just for buying the livestock. Did have to put in a $30,000 set of stockyards, and it probably would be handy to have another set on a different part of the farm, but we've saved that money on fertiliser anyway, because haven't put on any fertiliser for the last 3 years, so that's paid for the stockyards.
So how did you manage that? Are the beef cattle just not eating as much, or how does that work?
No, well, we're nowhere near as heavily stocked as what we were in dairy, so because we're understocked, probably at a beast to every acre and a half. As soon as you get to December, the grass just grows away from the cattle. And most people know about the concept of Maori hay, like in New Zealand. So what they don't eat in December and January, they eat right up until June and July the next year. And hopefully, by the time that's gone, the new growth starts.
And what about your other inputs, something like irrigation? How has that changed?
Well, we did irrigate a large portion of the farm, and of course water is not cheap. We do have 9 dams on the property, but it only takes a few weeks for them to be emptied unless they're filled up again. So we're on the Sassafras Wesley Vale irrigation scheme. So at the moment we're just running 2 pivots, probably once a fortnight, just to keep the grass green so that when we do get a rain, the grass is away. But no, we've certainly cut right back on the irrigation water and the cost of it as well.
And what about the amount of work you need to do around the farm? Has there been a bit of a labour saving as well?
Yes, we've gone from about 3 or 4 labour units, including part-time labour units, back to just a single-man operation. And there's been a huge labour saving, but there's all sorts of things. You don't get your tracks because the cattle are only sort of coming up your tracks once a week instead of the cows walking backwards and forwards twice a day. There's hardly any grading and stuff like that to be done.
So how much are you making per animal?
Well, the 300 odd head that we've bought over the last 12 months or so, and probably paid an average of probably $1,100 to $1,200 per head. That's for for weaners, 300 kilograms plus. We're just starting to sell some now, 15 months later, and we just sold a truckload here last week for $7.20 a kilogram. Quite a few of those were heifers, and we averaged $2,100 a head. So that leaves us with a profit margin per beast of about $1,000 in 15 months, and if you work that out over 12 months, that's a profit margin or a capital gain, if you like, of $800 in 12 months. So,
and you're expecting to make a bit of a better return in beef compared to dairy?
No, not at all. No. We're very fortunate to have paid off any debt that we had with the dairy. So now we're debt-free. So hopefully just make enough money to get by with the system we have. And if anyone wants to be keen enough to push things further, then they'll certainly make a better profit.
And in the meantime, you can sit back and take it easy, more or less.
Yes, hopefully. Hopefully that's the way it'll work out. Just sit back and get out of bed at 8 o'clock and a couple of hours work a day and not much else.
That's Wesley Vale farmer Geoffrey Lone chatting there to Lachlan Bennett about his switch from dairy to beef going well. Time now to check the latest on the weather. Deb Tabor joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Deb.
Hello, Tony. How are you?
I'm going well, going really well. Let's look at the weather, Deb. What's happening with rainfall? Anything?
Nothing much, Tony. Up to 9 a.m, the highest was 4 millimetres at 3 Hummock Island. And then since 9 a.m, we haven't had anything significant in the gauge. Pretty fine across the state. Very chilly start, though, so a lot of sub-zero temperatures. And, of course, Lyweenie was the lowest with -6.5 this morning. And Tunnock around -2, Mount Wellington -4. So pretty chilly in most places. Up around Launceston, they were 0 degrees, and Cressy -2. So we've got a bit of cloud around the state through the lower east and the southeast, and then some high-level cloud and a bit of cumulus up around the northwest of the state. But there is a band in the middle that sort of stretches from around Low Rocky Point to St Helens that's nice and fine. So nice and clear, sunny skies through there.
Okay. What are we expecting the next few days?
Well, we've got this ridge of high pressure over Tasmania at the moment. That's bringing the light winds, very cold starts, and chiefly east to northeasterly winds are fine for the rest of today. It's not a lot of difference for Friday and Saturday. It's the high that's pushing that ridge across us. That sits to the southeast of us, and still a weak ridge to our east. So widespread frost again for Friday and Saturday morning. Friday fine apart from the chance of light showers about the Bass Strait Islands. And Saturday, the widespread morning frost and fine apart from possible showers about the far northeast. For Sunday, that high is almost stationary to the southeast, but there is a broad low that is moving south of the Bight, but it does weaken as it approaches Tasmania. So for Sunday, fine apart from possible showers about the northwest. Light winds tending north to northeasterly and freshening about the northwest. And on Monday, that low moves to the southwest of the state, bringing showers to the north, but mostly fine everywhere else on Monday. So continuing pretty good for school holidays, but if you're up in the north, expect some showers on Monday, around 2 to 10 millimetres. It'll be a north to northeasterly stream, tending north to northwesterly late. And it looks like further showers for the north and into the west on Tuesday.
Okay, any warning step?
We just have a road weather alert, so that's for icy roads tomorrow morning for most districts, or all districts actually.
Okay, just take care if you're driving anywhere in the morning.
Yeah, coastal definitely.
Coastal waters and swell, what's happening there?
Okay, for the rest of today, variable winds about 10 knots, tending east to northeasterly 5 to 15 knots about the north and the west, and reaching 20 knots in the northwest late. For tomorrow, southeast to northeast winds 5 to 15 knots, reaching 20 knots about the northwest, but variable to 10 knots through the east still. Seas up to 1.5 metres. Just before midday, Cape Sorrel reported the wave rider on 2.6 metres with a maximum of 4 metres and a period of 12 seconds. Mariah Island reported 2 metres with a maximum of 3.5 and a period around 12 seconds. And at 9 a.m. at Syke Island, a southerly swell of 2 metres. So for the rest of today and tomorrow in the west and south, a south to southwest swell of 2 to 3 metres, lowering to 1.5 to 2 metres tomorrow, then tending west to southwesterly in the evening. About the north, a confused swell below 1 metre, and through the east, a southerly swell of 1 to 2 metres, reaching 3 offshore in the south today, but generally decreasing to around 1 to 1.5 metres tomorrow. And there's also a northeasterly swell there near 1 metre, decreasing tomorrow.
OK, Deb, done the wave riders, have we?
We have, yes. Yeah. Probably all a bit fast today with that ridge of high pressure and not a lot of weather around other than frost and cold days. But temperatures coming up just a little bit, Friday, Saturday and Sunday. Coldest day today for maximum temperatures, especially with the cloud cover inhibiting those rises during today. But temperatures coming up a little bit for the oncoming days.
Beauty. Thanks for that, Deb.
No worries. Have a good day.
It's Deb Tabor from the Bureau.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Frosty in the mornings, but that means nice days. So you can't have it both ways, can you? Just got to put up with it. At least you see some of the sun. Dairy now and Bega Cheese has given farmers in far north Queensland what it says is the strongest pricing in the country in a bid to stem the loss of milk production in the Sunshine State. Farmers in the once proud dairying region of the Atherton Tableland were left disillusioned and disappointed 1 month ago when negotiations with Bega failed to deliver any increase in the milk price. But that changed yesterday with Bega's chief executive chairman Barry Irvin forced to admit the original contracts were not good enough.
So the truth is, Charlie, and I said this to the suppliers today, the only thing that's changed is the feedback that they have given us. So nothing's changed in the market, nothing's changed in the circumstances of the company, but we do want to demonstrate that we will hear feedback and we will take on board the commentary, both through the Dairy Farmers Milk Cooperative, which is the entity that has a direct supply arrangements up there, but also directly to myself and directly to a number of our field service staff, etc. So it was really taking on board the feedback we got.
So it has nothing to do with how the southern market is playing out and the apparent three-way bidding war that you've found yourself in with Lactalis and Norco in the south of the state?
So in terms of that, I suppose the North Queensland farmers do see that as a market that is very relevant to them and therefore were making those comparisons. They wanted to feel like it was more of an alignment between Southeast and North Queensland. But as I said to them, on the one hand, happy to receive that feedback and respond accordingly. But on the other, I would never want to pretend that each of those markets are exactly the same or their circumstances are exactly the same. But in this case, it was part of the feedback we received from the farmers and part of what we responded to.
Have you achieved that parity, Barry Irving?
Yes, from our perspective, we pay in kilograms of butter fat and protein. So on a milk solids basis, which is the most logical way to pay from a dairy company's point of view, because you're fundamentally buying those component parts of a litre of milk, and we are at parity with this slight change, if not just very fractionally in terms of kilos of milk solids very slightly ahead.
Yet some would argue that it's still not an accurate comparison because it doesn't factor in the extra costs that they say are involved with dairying in far north Queensland, the freight and the extra inputs.
So that's a question and a commentary that I receive across the country. Whether it's in Victoria where people are celebrating a price that is only just moved into the $7 a kilo milk solids area, or in the Bega Valley that is $7.70, or up in North Queensland where it's $9.61 a kilo milk solids. So this is more than just about price. I accept that there are different input costs in different regions. Different regions have different advantages and different disadvantages. But you know, pricing, it's not just about what it costs to produce. It's also about the returns you can get out of a particular market and out of a particular product range. And we need to assist farmers where we can in helping with procurement, milk costs, all those sorts of things. That's about strategies for each region. But that commentary around different input costs around different regions, that's the same as a commentary around different milk prices for different regions.
Doesn't it show the full extent of the milk crisis, though, in Queensland, that you are willing to kind of respond with these price drivers because there just is so little volume being produced?
Look, we've only owned Lion Dairy and Drinks for just on 6 months, and I would be the first to say that the diminishing volumes of milk are a concern, and we need to understand all of the factors that have caused that. And you know, if I was to draw a comparison, Charlie, I've been in the industry a very long time. When I joined the industry, the Bega Valley and North Queensland were both isolated regions with both around about the same amount of farm numbers and the same amount of milk. And the difference now between those two regions is marked. And the interesting thing about that is even though the price in North Queensland is significantly above the price in the Bega Valley, it hasn't addressed the multiple reasons why supply continues to drop, and we need to actually think about strategies going forward. And it was indeed what I was talking to suppliers about today. They also need to have confidence that we want milk, and that hasn't always been the signal that they've received, as I understand it.
The boss of Bega Cheese, Barry Irvin, explaining to Charlie McKillop a small concession in milk price being offered to far north Queensland farmers. It's part of a bigger vision to rebuild confidence in the Queensland's depleted dairy industry. Over $9 they're being paid per kilo of milk solids. Well, mastitis, pregnancy testing, artificial insemination, bull fertility testing, herd health. It's the work of a dairy vet. It's varied and involves driving hundreds of kilometres through some of Australia's luscious landscapes every week. Carl Hockey spends much of that travel time listening to the ABC. Jennifer Nichols caught up with him in the picturesque Merry Valley.
Okay.
We've got a plan.
Righto.
I come, the AI, the 13, 14, and then we just preg test.
Okay, well, there'll be a heap of them.
That's okay.
All right.
Well, I've set aside that day because we're going to do 200 AIs. Now we're going to do 200 preg tests instead.
It's early in the morning and dairy vet Carl Hockey is busy on his rounds.
Help dairy farmers just getting their cows healthy and right and in calf, so that's pretty much my job.
And how long have you been doing this?
Nearly 20 years.
What a change you would have seen in the industry over that time, so many people leaving.
There has been a lot, I always say stay positive, and it's really encouraging to see that probably this year at least has been the first time I've seen a little bit of lift in optimism, and I think there's still a future there. So I hope the farmers feel the same way. Otherwise, I'll have no one else to support.
Do you think that's because of the new systems they brought in with more clarity around pricing?
Definitely improving pricing's the main driver of it all, for sure. But an improved season as well, combined with better pricing and a slight reduction in some of their inputs. Other things probably still always go up. But, yeah, it's hopefully just a bit of a turn for the better, and there's some people that be able to stay in there.
And so tell me about how far you would travel afield.
I do a lot of kilometres. Most of my customers anywhere from an hour to 3 hours drive away. So I operate from Brisbane and head out north through to Gympie and west out to Oakey and south through the scenic rim and Northern Rivers, New South Wales.
Gosh, you'd see some gorgeous countryside.
I've got the best job in the world.
He
Yeah, it's fantastic. I've got to pinch myself, so get up before the sun and see sunrises in every beautiful part of the great southeast. Probably 50 to 100 farms that I work with, and see them depending on how many preg tests they might have, a few times, some of them every sort of 4 to 6 weeks, and others a couple of times a year.
Carl Hockey, how more efficient has dairy farming become in Queensland in the 20 years you've been working in the industry?
Pretty much they've had no choice but to make improvements or they'll get left behind. Farms have got bigger. The number of cows they have and litres that each cow does, there's definitely a huge amount of efficiencies that have come. Pretty much I started just after deregulation, so I was sort of just as it all started changing.
So where is most of the semen coming from?
Well, the semen that we use for artificial insemination, you have some that comes internationally and some that's done here in Australia. The genetic companies manage all that and they distribute that all around Australia. There's a number of different companies that provide those services to the farms. And yeah, there's quite a lot of genetic choice. And now we've got a whole lot of improvement programs in Australia where there's monitoring of which genetics best match our conditions for everything from how to improve the fertility of cows to how to change their better conformation so they have less health issues and things like that.
It must be fascinating.
Yeah, it certainly is. There's massive advancements in genetics and there's tests we can do now that from the moment a calf is born, we can tell with as much accuracy of what her future might be as if she has been in the herd for 7 lactations, which that kind of blows your mind a bit.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? Dairy vet Carl Hockey talking there to Jennifer Nichols about his line of work. On the text line, Brian says, have a great day, Tony. It's only 5.8 degrees here, but with the sunshine, it feels much better than that. And he thought I might like to see the overindulged chooks sunbathing. The photo hasn't loaded yet, Brian, but I'm sure they're very healthy chooks and very happy chooks as well.
The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, drones and gene editing technology is being used in a new study to breed barley with better root systems. Researchers from the University of Queensland, the Australian National University, Intergrain, and one of the largest barley breeding companies in Australia are undertaking trials in southern Queensland. As Lucy Cooper reports, there's hope that with better barley root systems, there'll be improved yield stability, particularly in dry seasons.
Researchers are taking to the skies to better understand what is happening underground in the root systems of barley crops.
Yeah, we're using drones fitted out with the latest sensing technology, so multispectral cameras, and we're measuring traits on the canopy of the crop, which could be reflective of what's going on underground.
University of Queensland's Associate Professor Lee Hickey says by understanding different root traits, yield stability can be improved across the nation.
Modern plant breeding over the last 100 years or so, you know, has led to pretty significant increases in productivity in Australia, which is fantastic. Plant breeding works. It's amazing. And plant breeders have largely focused on above ground traits. So flowering time, for example. And this has really helped improve productivity, reduce risk for growers around drought and heat and frost. However, we don't really know what's happened underground as a consequence of all that selection. Perhaps we've lost genetic variation for different types of root systems. And so these are some of the key questions we are exploring in the new project. A good example is canopy temperature, which could give us clues around how much water the crop is using or how much water the crop has access to through modified root systems.
And there is another technology that you are utilising, and it's called CRISPR. Can you just give me a little overview of what CRISPR is and how you're using it for this particular research?
Yeah, this is a really exciting part of the project because we're using the latest genome editing technology, CRISPR, to create new genetic variation for root systems. And the problem is, like many of our crops, barley has a large and complex genome, so many, many genes. Which ones do we edit? Well, we're trying to take lessons learned from model plant species that have much smaller genomes. And so by targeting these key genes in barley, with genome editing, we can hope to see some nice translation of those root changes coming through. If we compare this sort of directed mutation technology to what's going on in a paddock, scientists have done the sums and they've worked out that in a standard crop of wheat, in a 1 hectare scale, about 10 billion mutations are occurring naturally each year. So we're talking about inducing one or two, very precise and targeted manner.
With this barley research project, what is your intended outcomes?
The main outcomes we're hoping for are new varieties that offer improved yield stability for farmers in Australia. And let's face it, farming in Australia is really challenging. The reality is that climate change is happening now as well. And so farmers, you know, in these regions around the country are going to benefit through new varieties that have improved yield stability, you know, essentially better root systems to cope with climatic variability.
UQ's Associate Professor Lee Hickey. Intergrain barley breeder Dr. Hannah Robinson says industry relevancy and collaboration is key to the success of the project.
We all contribute different skills that really bring together a great research collaboration. So, you know, the Australian National University bring together some more discovery elements to the research project where they're looking at more the hormones that can potentially target roots. The researchers at the University of Queensland bring their expertise in phenotyping root systems and looking at genetics that control roots. And then Intergrain, look, we're really looking at how we can take this research and the new technologies developed and apply it in a practical way to plant breeding.
Tell me how this is going to have an impact on the industry once the research is over and done with?
As breeders, we've never really bred for or selected for roots because it's just so hard to measure. We really don't have the time to dig deep and look at the root system. So, you know, using drone technology and trying to develop an alternative measure that we can still get some feel for what the roots might be doing, but is fast and efficient that we can actually apply in our breeding program would just be amazing.
In terms of this project, how are you ensuring that the quality of the barley and the grain itself is not being sacrificed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, this research is just one element of our breeding program and our different research projects that, you know, as breeders, we then take all these different components and that's when we combine them into varieties for release. So the knowledge we gain here, we will likely combine that with other elements of the barley in terms of genes that drive good quality, good yield, good disease resistance and package that together.
That's Intergrain barley breeder Dr. Hannah Robinson speaking there with Lucy Cooper. And doing that research into breed barley with better root systems. The results of the research project are expected sometime in December with hopes the research could be applied to both wheat and oat breeding programs as well. Well, a farm in southern Tasmania will be the location for the world's biggest field of a variety loved throughout Nepal and Asia. 10 hectares of purple gomphrena flowers will be planted in a huge circular pattern in a multi-million dollar investment. The owner of the Orielton farm, Dr. Kieran Tharpa, says people will be able to walk the circular paths through the flower fields once the project is completed.
We want to grow gomphrena flowers and then we want to start with a very small area and we want to take it to the bigger scale as well. Around 10 hectares of land, we want to grow the flowers and then use that as an agritourism project as well.
And you're going to grow the biggest gomphrena flower field in the world.
That's correct.
How big eventually will it be?
We have got the outline for 10 hectares, which is 46 concentric circles. We have got that in the rings. And then total length of the rings, which we call the flower bed, would be 28 kilometers. What we want to do this year, I mean, last year we started with few rings, and then this year we want to go a little bit more, and then eventually we'll get there. So we have got the 46 rings constructed already.
So why is it grown in rings? Is that tradition?
No, it's just there's no such tradition, but as I said, I just wanted to have some aesthetic value as well while I'm growing this flower so that it becomes an attractive place for people to come in and enjoy the flower field. Like, you know, when the flowers are blooming, then I want to open this to the tourists and people can have the picnics in the flower field. So we got the 2.5 meters of gap. So 2.5 meter, and then we got the flower bed, another 2.5 meter gap and the flower bed and so on. So people can walk around, people can sit in there and do the picnic and do the yoga and all these things. So that's why I wanted to create the aesthetic value. So there's no significance of building this in circle whatsoever.
What about the flower itself? Now, you're originally from Nepal. What's the significance culturally of the flower Gomphrena?
But the flower itself in Nepal, we use this as a for the cultural reason. Like a Nepalese Hindu, where they celebrate the Diwali festival over 5 days, one of days being blessing, extending the blessing between the siblings, and they extend the garlands as well. So the significance of the flower literally lasts. It lasts for the dried flower, the cut flower. The color lasts longer, and then the cultural significance is that the relationship between the siblings are supposed to last literally forever. So that's what our cultural significance is.
Now the flower, you've got trial patches growing at the moment at Orielton. How's it going?
Obviously, as I said, it requires the hot and warm weather. Obviously, Queensland and the Western Australia, you know, I have seen the flowers blooming very nicely. And even the, I think there's one in Auckland Botanic Gardens, they have done it. But Tasmania was the first time I tried it. And then it's a cold weather. Obviously, you know, I had a lot of struggle and hiccups. And I didn't even know how long the flowers will go and whether I would be able to grow the flower in the first place. But yeah, we started from last September, and then the first bloom we saw was in December. And then the flowers were there for up to 6 months. Like we have harvested it already. I think 2 weeks ago we harvested it, but the flowers as such were there in the field for 6 months. It didn't grow as tall as we expected, but that's okay. I mean, that being the first year, now we know what to do. But the flowers, we managed to get it done, and we are successful. So the flowers bloomed for 6 months. So now for the next year, we're improvising our techniques and we're trying to do a little bit bigger and the better.
And the investment you're doing at the property, is it quite a huge amount?
The initial investment is 1.5 million. However, we want to stage this up over the next 5 years, and then when the farm is open to the visitors, then we're going to ramp it up, and then I'm expecting it to go up to 5 million.
And what's the flower look like?
The flowers can be found in like 9 different colors, but we're choosing the purple. We just want it to be unique and specific. The flowers is just like round, like I think it's called like a type of daisy, the dried daisy type of thing. Small bulb. It's a globe. I mean, it's called Gomphrena globosa. That's why it attracts the butterflies, and it also attracts the honeybees.
And other Gomphrena flower farms in the world, what size are they? Do they come anywhere near it?
Yeah, the thing is that, like in Nepal, they just use this as a garland. They have never explored this as a herbal tea, so no one has done it in as a commercial venture in that big scale. And then, like, there's one in New Zealand, Auckland Botanic Garden. It's just like a little bit of their garden is allocated for this flower. And then even from my research so far, no one, because there's no such commercial value, unlike other flowers and other, you know, other crops where they also have the byproducts like sunflower. You've got the beauty and then also got the, you know, sunflower seeds. But in this flower, no one has explored that thing. That's why no one has done it in the commercial scale. So my research shows, you know, this 28 kilometer covering over 10 hectares would be the largest flower field in the world.
That's Dr. Kieran Tharpa and the huge investment in a Gomphrena flower farm at Orielton in southern Tasmania. And just before we go, Roger says, got to love our dairy farmers. Where would we be without them? Agree, Roger. Fantastic. Well done. They helped the wallabies across the line last night. That's our program for today. We will catch you after midday tomorrow.